Welcome to Bellwether Friends, definitely not the first podcast featuring a discussion of pop culture and why we think you should like what we like. You should trust us because we're librarians, and librarians are definitely not evil. I'm Anna, and I am an evil librarian.
I'm Aline, and I make really good cheese scallion biscuits.
Yes, you do. Every couple of weeks, we'll get together with someone and chat about a couple of pop culture topics, what we think and how we feel. We'll end the show with our current obsessions. Today, we have with us Corey, a librarian in Texas and a head of the, what do you call yourself? The Gorilla Storytime? No. The Storytime Underground. It's early. So welcome, Corey.
Thank you.
Yay.
We're glad to have you.
We are glad to have you. You maybe are more awake than I am, but.
Well, I've been awake since 3, so.
Yeah, so you've like put in a full day already.
Yeah.
I got up and then I took a nap and now I'm here.
We usually record at night, so that's all right. Someone will be at their peak.
There'll be a shift in the balance of power in this episode.
No.
See if you notice who's the morning person.
I don't know. Who could it be?
Harlan, the morning person.
He's the morning person,
oh,
yeah.
Harlan.
There's a kitten upstairs who's the morning person.
Oh my god.
She's really mad that we confined her for the purposes of this episode, because she wanted to knock some stuff over while we were talking.
Of course.
So today we're going to talk about historical romance, and we've assembled a panel of ourselves to do so. Something that we all read and enjoy and want to talk about in general, so you can just basically listen in on our conversation. And something I always forget, but we'll say now, is that if you have anything that you want to talk to us about, you can reach us on Twitter at BellwetherFriends, FRNDS, or on Facebook, or just like sending an owl, Harry Potter style, and we'll respond to your questions, concerns, and book suggestions.
Email.
Email, yeah. BellwetherFriendsPodcast@gmail.com.
And if you use our blog,
just
the contact links.
Right. So I always forget that you might want to contact us, but in case you do.
We love to hear from you.
So we're going to talk about historical romance. We're going to start by discussing everyone's history of when they started reading historical romance. And we'll start with Corey. Tell us when you got started. What did you read?
I think when I was, I have this sort of story that everybody has about reading some when you're, you know, 12 or 13 and sort of thinking about sex for the first time, although I'm more gay than straight, so I think I was just like, what is happening here?
Was it surreptitious or was it out in the open?
I don't think my parents really cared. My mom was more concerned about whether or not they were like good feminism,
right,
than like the fact that there was sex in them.
Go Corey's mom!
Yeah, so when I was 14, I really specifically remember that I went on a trip to England and I was staying in a B&B and I didn't have a book to read. And the woman who owned the B&B gave me Lace, which someone had left there. And I don't know if y'all have read Lace, but it's not really a traditional romance novel. It's more of like 80s era dynasty style, like high melodrama with a lot of sex in it.
Who is that by?
Sorry,
we can look it up.
But it's dirty, like filthy. Like there are scenes I'm still traumatized by.
If you were in the UK, you were ripe to lay your hands on some Jilly Cooper.
I got a hold of this book and I was reading it on the airplane and I was like, what is happening here? And then I sort of got my hands on a few of those mid-90s like sweeping family epics where each book is a generation and somebody gets kidnapped by like the Shah of something and is part of their harem, and I was done for a while because I was not interested in that. So I actually didn't read romance for a number of years, and then I was introduced to Smart Bitches Trashy Books,
right.
And they were able to give me recommendations for things that were not rapey or kidnappy or any of those. And so then I started reading a lot of more romance in grad school.
In lieu of doing your reading for school.
Sure. Right.
When we were in college, Angie and I had this useless closet above our closet, like a little tiny nook, and you could jam yourself in there if you worked hard at it. So we put some pillows and like a stack of romance novels up there, and then we didn't go up there much, but it was good to have that place of respite in case you needed it. Yes, including Hot Arctic Nights. One of my favorites. We were in a class where we discussed romance novels, and so we had a bunch of ones that the professor had to like hand out and read and then discuss.
So when did you get started reading romance?
When did I get started? I read my mom's romance novels. So she had a collection. She was majorly into historical romance, and so that's where I started. I didn't start with romance in general. Maybe that's why I still favor historical. I'm not sure. But
I want you to know that if you Google Lace, which is by Shirley Conran, U-N-R-A-N, the Google autofills Lace novel Goldfish, which is the scene I'm still traumatized by.
Alrighty then.
19 years later. There's a goldfish involved. Go on.
Yeah, I don't think I need to read it. I'm good. So, but she read these long series that had sex in them, I believe, and I started reading, the ones I start remembering reading were the Jane Feather books that all started with V, like Vixen and Velvet and I don't even know, but I discovered that they had explicit sex scenes in them, and I was like, well, this is interesting, I'll just reread that part over and over again.
Studying up.
Right, for my career as a straight lady. And I don't remember, like, in a lesbian romance novel, they'll be like, you have the idea that the lesbians are, like, reading a romance novel and they're not sure whether they want to be the hero or the heroine. No, I just liked reading the sexy bits. I didn't feel like it was not relevant to me, since it was historical romance anyway. I was perfectly happy translating it to my experience and my imagination.
Awesome.
So yeah, she also read Georgette Heyer and Patricia Varian, who we will speak on later. But we shared those reading tastes until she died 10 years ago. How about you, old lady?
I've been reading romances since. I used to spend the summer, or a portion of the summer, at my grandmother's house when I was young, from the ages of 7 to 14. And one of my aunts was a subscription Harlequin reader. And so she got the white cover Harlequins for 6 a month, forever and ever. And so there were shopping bags full of them at my grandmother's house. And I started reading those, I don't know, probably when I was 10 or 11, because I was a reader and I was at my grandmother's house for the entire summer. And we didn't go to the library. I was, because there were books in the house. I mean, there were Bobsy Twins and Nancy Drew and stuff. And
yeah, but why read those?
Right. Well, I'm sure I read those originally. And then one summer, dun, dun, dun.
Did you become a woman?
In a way. I think I was probably 12, and I was in the back bedroom that I didn't usually sleep in. I slept in one bedroom, and then the other bedroom was
full of romance novels. In my imagination, it's like full of bags of romance novels.
No, it was they were on a shelf, and I found Kathleen Woodowitz, and I read The Wolf and the Dove and The Flame and the Flower. Those are two, not four, novels. One of them, The Wolf and the Dove, is medieval, and as Corey was referencing, we may talk a little bit about this later. Very rapey and very kidnappy. So The Wolf and the Dove is the knight and the red-haired, green-eyed dove.
Uh-huh.
And The Flame and the Flower was New Orleans antebellum? Seems like, or maybe it was during the war. These were epic. They were like 2 inches thick. And like I said, rapey and kidnappy, and published in the 70s. And we picked up copies of them. I haven't...
Yeah, they're on the shelf now.
...had Anna read them yet. But they were illuminating. And my mom was a librarian, and I read romance, and I was reading romances as soon as I quit reading Nancy Drew, I guess. And I was of the generation that Sweet Valley High began to be published in like 7th or 8th grade. And so I was like, oh, my friends, wait till you see what I have. Because they're like, Sweet Valley High, all these romances, and they're just so exciting. And I'm like, well, let me show you this.
It's like pulling it out of your coat here. You want to try this?
But so I sort of missed the boat on that, that I know that many people of y'all's generations may have read some of, depending on your sourcing.
Not a one.
Not y'all, I guess.
Did you read any Sweet Valley High, Corey?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I did. I think that there was a time, like, I was a really advanced reader, but not a really mature emotional reader. And so my dad especially kept trying to give me like Pride and Prejudice and Gone with the Wind and stuff, which I could read in terms of reading level, but I had no idea what was happening.
Yes.
So I think that before I discovered like Agatha Christie, so like 2nd grade probably, I was reading a lot of those Nancy Drew and Sweet Valley High and Babysitter's Club and stuff where there was a lot of content that I could, you know, there are a million books.
Right.
And so it didn't matter if I finished like one a day.
Yeah, it was like 10 books a week at that, some summer vacations. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the stuff that I was challenging to me reading wise, I couldn't, I had no idea what was going on. Because that was a world before, you know, The Secret of the Series of Unfortunate Events and The Mysterious Benedict Society and the, you know, Lou Baylette books and all these amazing books that kids have now who are advanced readers, but on target with their emotional maturity. So we didn't have that when I was a kid. We just had series that were really dumb or stuff that was way beyond where you...
Fear Street.
No, I didn't read... So I don't know... What I was, I think I was reading, like, dude fantasy authors, because I didn't read any Babysitter's Club or any Sweet Valley High or any R.L. Stine or Goosebumps or whatever. I just missed it completely.
I read Jackie at some point. I think that was a little bit later, though.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about tropes in historical romance, since we've all read a bunch of it. And we're going to start at the top. We're going to say that this is going to be super white and super straight, most historical romance. And we'll talk about alternatives later, but right now we're going to talk about what your typical white straight historical romance is going to be like. Now, most of the time the setting is going to be,
I always like to say that I want to read historical romance that are set in London in 1813 with anachronistically saucy heroines.
Sounds about right.
That is really a lot of... I require explicit sex. But that's really what a lot of what you're going to see in your supermarket historical romance covers, with the curly letters, and they're published by Avon and that kind of thing.
Okay, so I made a list last night with my mom.
Great.
Who's also... a huge number. Okay.
Crowdsourcing.
So someone accidentally gets into somebody else's carriage.
Yes, that happens all the time.
One of them is pretending to be someone that they're not.
Yeah.
Usually they're like a duke or an earl or something, and they're pretending to be not. The family sets up the marriage, or you have to get married because it's in somebody's will.
Yep.
And you in love with them anyway. Somebody accidentally gets compromised, even though, like, compromise being like has to get married because of their honor, even though like they weren't actually doing anything. They used to be married and then they split up for some horrible reason, but now they're getting back together. One of them has some terrible secret that if the other one finds out, it will destroy their love, but it never does. Let's see, they've known each other all their lives and they hate each other.
Right.
Bonus points if she's been in love with the younger rogue brother all her life, but she ends up marrying the older serious brother.
The responsible one.
The Sabrina.
They, of course, the classic rogues who change for the right woman. Also dukes who are somehow really hot, even though there are like 5 dukes in England and they're all really, really, really inbred.
Inbred, right. Also, there's a proliferation of dukes. I looked up a list of tropes, and the top number was dukes.
Yeah. His older brother dies, leaving him the heir, so he suddenly has to become responsible.
Right.
He wins or loses a game of cards and somehow like wins her or
her house or her uncle.
Yeah. He needs a mother for his children. She's his nanny. She's an old maid. She's an orphan and an heiress.
Yeah, that happens.
And an old maid.
And an old maid. They are thrown together because one of them is finding the other one a suitable husband or chaperoning the other one's little sister or teaching the other one how to get along in society or solve a crime, and they hate each other. This is not the plot of just historical romance novels.
It's
the plot of every... And then my last one is she's somehow an anachronistically professional woman. Bonus points if she's a newspaper reporter.
Right, that's a good one.
The lady journalist.
The lady journalist. This is the one that wrote the secret gossip magazine, Lady
Whistledown.
Whistledown. So, yeah. So what I want to ask is, a lot of these things are true of all, like, many romance novel genres, like contemporary or even paranormal. So what is it...
Carriage rides.
Not the carriage rides, right. So what is it that makes the appealing historical romance? Like, why is it that we're drawn to... historical rather than contemporary.
I know.
Go ahead.
I like them because I can pretend that since I wasn't there, I don't really know whether this is reasonable or not. If I'm reading a non-historical romance and they can't possibly be together for some stupid reason, I'm like, that's a stupid reason. Why aren't you in bed now? This book could be much shorter.
So... there are built into the society of, you know, turn of the 19th century England, many restrictions already on dudes and ladies getting together. Mm-hmm. And so the obstacles are a lot more, quotation mark, realistic. I, for one, like a little historical detail in my romances, and that's a double-edged sword because... if I feel like they're getting it wrong, then I get irritated.
Oh, yeah. If they do forms of address or orders of precedence wrong, I lose my mind. But let me tell you, I can cover the Napoleonic Wars in Jeopardy, thanks to
George.
Well,
that's what I was
going to
say. We have answered many a Jeopardy question correctly due to our reading of historical romances. So, Corey, would you say, if you're picking up a romance, are you going to pick up a historical, or is it like... you like historical among other romance subgenres?
I read a lot of genres. I think it depends on the author. There are some authors who I like their contemporaries better than their historicals. Victoria Dahl, for instance, I love her contemporaries and I'm sort of on her historicals. Lisa Kleypas, I like her contemporaries as well.
Oh, yeah, I do too.
I mean, I think they're really, really well done. But yeah, I sort of think that what I like about a well-written historical novel, romance novel, is when it manages to walk the tightrope between like not being really misogynist, but also not being really anachronistic.
Yes.
And so part of it is that I'm looking for things that manage to sort of do that writing bit well, because I enjoy watching authors figure out how to do that, how to write romance novels for a modern society.
I like that a lot. Can I use it? Walking the fine line between anachronism and misogyny.
That's beautiful.
It's brilliant.
If we had a review website, we would use that as our tagline.
Yes.
So I think, you know, there are authors. I do read a lot of different genres, and I wrote down some recommendations of like, if you want historical but you want vampires, or right. If you want historical but you actually want the 1920s, or you know.
So that leads me to another question, which is there a particular period that you like to read about?
Well, I mean, as you guys said, most mass market historical romance is set in the Regency era during the Napoleonic Wars. And so I read a lot of that because it's what's out there.
Yep.
Who is it? Laura Lee Gerke has a series called The Altar.
Love them.
That is... the 20s, and it's so phenomenal. It's so good.
They're almost like Miss Fisher.
They are, yeah. And there's especially one, I love the trope of people who were in love and then split up over a misunderstanding and then get back together. And so there's one of those, and the heroine is like a total flapper girl, like drives her car too fast and smokes cigarettes and has bobbed her hair. And
Lady Julia.
she's awesome, and she's madly in love with her childhood love, and he goes off to Egypt to be an archaeologist, and she's like, "You're an irresponsible git because you are a lord, and you need to take over your estate, and there are people, a lot of people, who are actually relying on you," which I also like when historical romance novels, especially that are about earls or dukes or whatever, take on the some of the social commentary
Yeah,
of like these
discuss
people.
class at all.
Yeah. And so, what's interesting about those books is that it's very aware in a Downton Abbey way that they're set in a time when like you can't make money being an, you can't live off of the money of being an aristocrat anymore because there's not any.
Right.
And so the feudal land system, farming system doesn't make money anymore. So like the aristocracy has these huge estates and people, farmers, tenant farmers, and they can't support them. And what are they going to do? So, yeah, that particular book, which I don't, The Wound, whichever that one is my favorite of that series. But I think that that's a great series to get out of the Regency era if you're trying to avoid it. Now, there are some historical periods I don't read.
Yeah.
I don't read Highlander books
No kilt lifters.
because I feel like that time period is so sexist. I did read Outlander. I think I got stuck in the middle of Dragonfly and Amber because it was boring. But I don't read them because I feel like that time period is so sexist that I can't. The anachronism, it doesn't walk the fine line. Like.
I feel like when I was experimenting with time periods, that all the medieval ones I tried, I was like, no.
So
No one's washing and there's rape and this is like, the early 90s or whatever, and I was reading my mom's books from the 70s and 80s, and I was like, no one's washing and there's rape and kidnapping and I really like knights and castles and stuff, and I need to keep that separate from my romance novel reading.
I also don't read American history romance novels because either I find generally that they're set in a time when like they have to kind of ignore slavery or they have to or they're set with Native Americans but they're like the Cassie Edwards like the her savage lover kind of
Oh my
thing.
God. And so we would like a three-way high five on that one because we also not reading much of the American historical romance over here.
Well, there's always and I know that England has some terrible racism in their past and their
And
present,
present, yeah.
obviously Brexit. But I feel like American writers writing British romance novels sometimes feel like they have more leeway to talk about like the slavery debate. Like a lot of that stuff comes up in certain authors' novels, at least being mentioned. Whereas I feel like in American history novels, maybe it just feels too close, or it feels like if we bring it up, then it's not going to have this like beautiful, happy ending because actually, we own people. I don't know. I just have trouble with like suspending my what I know about American history to.
Yeah, I think that's one reason that even the American authors write British because it's easier to be creative, like Sarah McLean and her gaming hell run by
Sure.
lords or whatever.
I've tried very hard to put my finger on that because after reading romances as a pre-adolescent, I didn't read romances again until I was in my mid-20s, and a coworker got me hooked on historical romances like the Jude Devereaux Velvets and the Amanda Quick single word titles and Outlander, and I read the first four Outlander novels probably like in a sitting and loved them in spite of the issues with I think it is Dragonfly and Amber that is like, and then I mean it's like a melodrama, but then the fifth one is after they've come to America and I was like, boop, no interest.
Just where they're wandering around America building a house. That's the one that I was like, I don't care. That's when I quit.
There
Wandering
was
around America building a wood cabin in the middle of the woods. I was like, I don't care.
I think that Drums of Autumn opens with a Klan gathering in North Carolina or something. And I'm like, my grandparents were probably there. And I'm like, nope.
too close.
So I don't know where I was going with that. What were we talking about?
We were talking about...
We don't need American history.
Oh, yeah. No American history.
I felt that way. I was a history minor and an English major, and I did everything I could to avoid American literature and American history.
How very nationalistic of
right?
you.
I do love my country, except for the things people do in its name.
Yes.
I'd say that, like, within that basic time period, however, you know, 50-year time period that most mass market romance novels are set in, I like it when authors write about, get out of the nobility niche necessarily. So like Mary, do you say her last name Bellog,
like Kellogg.
Bellog, who's one of my favorites, has a whole bunch, most of her books are not about lords. There are a few nobility sprinkled in, but there are a lot of like school teachers who marry war vets, whatever. And Julianne Long has the Penny Royal Green series, and they're nobility, but they're like big wealthy families instead of being like dukes. So there's a lot of just like small town village life involved.
Yes.
It's nice to get away from the glittering ton.
Yeah. You were talking about people getting out of the Regency, and Bettina Krahn, K-R-A-H-N, has written some standalones. I discovered her kind of by accident. And my favorites of hers are The Husband Test, The Wife Test, and The Marriage Test, which are medieval. But she's also written things like one was the heroine was a dress reformer in the early Victorian period. So she was walking around in bloomers and trying to release women from their corsets in addition to falling in love with a non-noble dude. And so coming upon little treasures like that are...
Well, and Rose Lerner is really great for that. So she has a hero who is a tailor, and like that book is just awesome. I will look up the name of it any second now.
Spies. I love spies.
Spies are good.
Spies are fun, but they're always dukes. I mean, Celeste Bradley has a bunch of spies, and I loved them.
The spy who I loved?
The spy who I loved. Who's the other one with the... It's not Julianne Long. Joe Bourne does the spies.
My Lord and Spy Master, and yeah, that's a good series.
I liked some of those, and some of them I couldn't get into.
I like her way of writing.
Yeah.
A Lily Among Thorns is the Rose Lerner with the tailor and the infamous Lady Serena.
The infamous Lady Serena.
That book is great.
It is a great book. We are going to come up with a lot of great books to recommend.
We're gonna have a big long list. I wondered if you had the list of tropes posted somewhere, Corey, that we could link to.
No, but I definitely can. Put it somewhere.
Are you on the list app? Because that would be an ideal place. We could even do it if you sent us
we could add
items.
No,
it's all right. Have you been out of the loop lately for some reason?
Do you have a child under a year old?
Okay. So here's my question: do you prefer a just romance with some history, but only a little bit of history to set the scene? Do you like a detailed history with a little bit of romance? Do you prefer your romance mixed with some other genre for spice? Like, Amanda Quick often has a mystery that her hero and heroine are involved in. Or, you know, there are some paranormal elements to some romances. Go ahead.
Art Society book by Amanda Quick.
Right. I think we've all read Amanda Quick.
Go ahead, Corey.
So I mean, I've read all the Amanda Quick books. My favorite of hers are the Lake March series, which are of crime solving books. And the couple, it takes them like 3 or 4 books to get together, which I just like, gives you some more time. But I think that I would read more crime solving ones if I could find some more good ones.
Right.
I like that a lot.
Have you read Deanna Raeburn's Lady Julia Gray series?
Not yet. It's on my TV read list.
You would, that would probably fit the bill.
I like, really like, not really romance novels, but the, I actually think that Anna recommended them to me, the, Sebastian, what's his name? He's like a lord who solves crimes, and he's married. Sebastian St. Cyr is the series.
C.S. Harris, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So they're like historical crime novels, but there's a lot of romance in them. So I like that a lot, and I would probably read more of them if there were more good ones. But so I think I like it to be sort of half and half. Like, I would like it to be, there to be a fair amount of romance. I like it to be fairly explicit sex. I don't want to, I mean, I read Georgette Heyer, but otherwise, like, why are we just kissing? But I also don't want it to seem like it could be set anywhere.
Right.
I would like to feel like the author knows they're doing
something.
Yeah.
I feel so. I am fine with whatever amount of sexual explicitness, but I have to have some point to the plot other than, are they going to have sex? Oh, they're having sex. Okay, now. Because then if, when they're done having sex the first time, then I'm like, why should I keep reading?
So you want there to be a crime? Or
no, I don't really want there to be a crime. I'm not sure. I don't...
You need the history?
Yeah, I think I need the history.
Okay.
I have sort of... especially with historicals that are set in the Regency period, one of my favorite tropes is if they have to get married at the beginning of the book, because I have trouble reconciling that, like, women raised in the Regency period would be willing to lose their virginity outside of marriage.
Yes.
Like, I mean, certainly there were some, you know, women, lots of women have agency, and some of them, you know, have, everyone has their own moral code, but they were certainly brought up with a very strict moral and social code. And the number of them in romance novels who are just like...
Well, it's like the number of dukes.
Well, consequences seems really unlikely to me. So I like it when they are married at the very beginning of the novel and, like, are, it's like the, whether or not they're allowed to have sex is out of the way. And then they're figuring out the emotional stuff.
Have you read Sherry Thomas?
Yes, she's on my list of people to talk about how great she is.
Okay, good. Because she has done a couple of those that are very good.
I have, a friend of mine only wants to read ones where they start out married or when they get married right away, and then they have to work out the love and the connection. That's like her requirement, and it's pretty cool. I agree that it it takes some of the issues out, but sometimes I have trouble. It's like, well, you're stuck now, and you have to produce an heir and a spare, so why are you trying to hold him off? I have lots of issues.
I think that if you're like, you were getting into historical romance and you learned about these tropes, it would be good to narrow it down and be like, well, I like marriage of convenience, and I'm going to work on finding the best ones. Yeah. I worked with someone who had red hair, and so she only read romances with redheaded heroines, and that really helped her cut down on her options.
It does help narrow it down. We talked about the proliferation of dukes, and one of the things that I really like is the sweeping family epic where they cover the stories of all of the cousins or maybe a really vast family, and I'm thinking specifically of Julia Quinn's Bridgertons, thank you, Corey, and also Stephanie Lauren's Sinsters, which I admit to not having read the last several of both of those authors' offerings, but they were and remain beloved.
Yeah, I love the Bridgertons, and I love Lisa Claypool's Takeaways, which is some of her more recent stuff. I'm not in love with her older historicals, The Wallflowers. I wasn't that excited about.
But, yeah, she did. I read a tetralogy of hers that had, there was a whole lot of her Savage Lover with a Romani connection. Yeah, and I was like, I'm not into this.
Well, yeah. I think a couple of the Hathaways are that way. They're problematic, which is unfortunate because the women are really well written in those books. And then Loretta Chase's early stuff, The Mr. Impossible and
Lord of Scoundrels.
Those are all one family, if I remember correctly.
Was it the Mary Balog slightly series? Yeah. I think they were related in that way.
Yeah.
I like those to a point. I don't need all of my romances to be connected. Patricia Varian has several, like, 6 or 8 book series, and then, like, they're done. But they're not connected by family. They're connected by a historical plot, like the Jacobite Rebellion, and or this one series is called The League of Jeweled Men, because there's, like, someone plotting to take down the country.
Oh, Jeweled Men, that makes me think of, I love when they go back a generation before the Regency, and
yeah,
all
I
of
do
the
too.
Georgian
so,
patches.
Right,
and,
so some of Patricia Varian's have, like, guys in patches and wigs and powders and high-heeled boots, which is one of my things that's also in Goblin Moon. I do not mind adding fantasy to my historical romance, such as The Sorcerer and the Crown.
Oh, and I didn't even get to mine. I want the characters and the setting to be first. And so I need the backdrop, but I don't need there to be a plot apart from the romance.
No plot. No, thank you.
But I'm fine. I mean, Amanda Quick wrote 13 historical romances with single word titles, and I spent a couple of years of my life just reading all 13 of those and just starting over again and reading all 13 of them. and I, you know, when she started to branch out, and the two she wrote after those 13 were With This Ring and I Thee Wed, mm-hmm. and that was when it all went south for me. And so I read a lot of those, and, you know, they have sex by page 142, usually on or around page 142, and they have one of them always gets kidnapped and is caught, found before the end.
And Amanda Quick, one of the things I like about Amanda Quick is that she almost always, the characters are like, yeah, I'm in love with you. Like, there's not a lot of, like, emotional drama about, am I in love with you? Do I tell you? There's a lot of just like, yeah, we're in love. And then there's, like, some other outside force.
I prefer that as well. So what I don't like about Sarah McLean, for example, is that they take so long to come to some kind of agreement. There are so many, like, peaks and then valleys, and you're like, come on, just agree that you're going to be together and move on. Move yeah. on. I will, like, I think I was shouting at the last one. Like...
Speaking of Amanda Quick, did y'all know that Jane Ann Krentz used to be a librarian?
Yes. She lives in Seattle.
One of the reasons that I love her, although the last few books of hers that I read before I gave up were not good.
Oh, well. Let us talk about, since we've been talking about super white, straight,
yes.
historical romances, let us talk about some that are not super white and straight. And one of the ones that I discovered, I think through Twitter, that I really enjoy and recommend are Jeannie Lynn's historical. They're set in Asia. I'm trying to remember my favorite one involved an archer. I read My Lady Concubine. That was good. The Sword Dancer was good. So they are set, you know, like, the Sword Dancer is set in the Tang Dynasty. And so you're getting all sorts of interesting historical detail, but it's, if you've been reading, you know, your Regency romances, it's completely foreign and interesting and awesome. So I recommend Jeannie Lynn for sure.
I have not read her books because they don't have them on Overdrive, which is terrible because you should give Black women your money. But Rebecca Witherspoon, I follow on Twitter.
Witherspoon, yep.
She is Witherspoon, and she is fantastic at tweeting.
She is fantastic at tweeting. I haven't read anything historical by her.
I thought she had a historical series. Maybe I'm crazy. For some reason, I thought she had a historical series, but
I think we should definitely name drop her because she is a fantastic tweeter.
She also tweets a lot about other Black women romance.
She does.
Right? And so if you follow her on Twitter, you will get recommendations for awesome.
I think that you can't go wrong with Beverly Jenkins if you're looking for historical romance.
You sort of have to read Beverly Jenkins if you're looking for historical Black romance.
Right. I think I will just say historical romance.
Well, right. I mean, if you're specifically looking
for diverse,
diverse historical romance, there's the field is really narrow.
Yeah, it's not as narrow as we might think. It's just that the availability is hard. So I think Jeannie Lynn actually was publishing with Harlequin, and then, you know, they dropped the print on the end of her series or something. Like, they made it more difficult for someone to buy the books that she was putting out. And she's, like, the only one doing, you know, medieval China. So I wanted to turn to lesbian historical romance because that's my particular area of interest. I have a half-written one that Aileen has read. I'm sure it will be published sometime in the 2000s.
Sometime this century. Yes, indeed it will.
But so you know, I read historical romances, and then at some point I started reading lesbian romances. And then I was like, well, why can't I find historical lesbian romances? And they suffered for a very long time from the problem of being set in America. And so I read one called Yellow Throat about a female bandit, I think. And Patience and Sarah is the classic one. And I think that one's set in, like, Puritan times or something. None of these really are that thrilling. Patience and Sarah is 1969. Yeah. Early 19th century. Two women in Connecticut who fall in love and decide to leave their homes to buy a farm in another state and live in a Boston marriage.
Oh, a Boston marriage.
Oh, Boston marriages. And so, at some point, I just came across Pembroke Park, which is by Michelle Martin, and it is a lesbian Regency romance of the kind that you would want to read if you liked Regency romances and lesbian romances. And then I will put in a word also for Desert of the Heart, which is what the film Desert Hearts was based on. So that's set in the 50s in Nevada. But we would be happy for anyone to recommend diverse and specifically lesbian historical romances for me
to
read.
There's a series of steampunk historical romances set primarily in America, although they do go traveling, and I cannot at the moment remember the name of the series, although I will find it. But in the first one, the couple is spies, and they've built like a lightweight dirigible kind of device that they're using to go on a spy mission. And in the second one, they're on like a cross-country race to win money in airships and cars, and it's very like steampunk action adventure, but the heroine is Chinese.
All right.
So that's steampunk and some historical American and some
but it's good despite that.
It's not like it's a fast read, but there was nothing that I was immediately like, oh my god, what?
Is good.
In one of the Amanda Quick single word titles, the heroine is raised by her aunt and her aunt's very good friend.
I remember that. I remember reading that and being like, oh my god, oh my god.
In which, yeah. I think it's Deception, which is really awesome because of the heroine also raising her unruly nephews and the hero being an injured veteran who wears an eye patch and comes to be their tutor. And they think he's a pirate, and that goes over very well with the unruly nephews. But yeah, I remember being like, woo, lesbian aunts.
You know, there's a series of mystery novels that you recommended in the Franny Fisher episode about a girl who's a spy.
Yes.
In London, and she is also of Chinese descent.
Yes, she is. The agency.
Lots of romance in them.
Yes, they do.
Not romance novels, but there's lots of romance.
I like that.
And they're fun.
So what? So let's see. Put that on my list. Okay. So we will tweet any further things that come to mind or recommendations that we get. What I want to do now is each of us to give. Let's try to limit it to not more than 20 suggestions for authors or books. Yes.
Before we do that, I would like to invite all of our listeners to tweet us the prime example of any or all of Corey's tropes.
Okay.
I would like to read the pinnacle of each trope based on our listener recommendations. But yes, so we're just supposed to share our favorites?
Yeah, you can share your favorites. You can recommend.
Okay.
You can, I know Corey has a list, so we're going to make Corey go first.
Okay.
If you are into paranormal, obviously we said Amanda Quick, but there's also a series by Colleen Gleason called The Gardella Vampire Chronicles about a family of vampire hunters.
Okay.
And the main character is a spunky woman who takes over the family vampire hunting business, and she has a couple of love interests, and she ends up with one of them in the end.
Well, that's a relief.
And I think it's not the vampire, so that's also
also good.
If you really like alternate history and you have a strong stomach for not the heroine getting raped, but some rape content, I really love the Kashiel books. I think they're really phenomenal examples of world building and alternate history. They're set in an alternate French history, and they have dirty sex and palace intrigue and spies and murder, and they're really great. Let's see. If you do not like any sex at all in your books, I highly recommend Georgette Heyer. We talked about Mary Balogh, who's one of my favorites. We did not talk about Mary Jo Putney, who is a favorite of mine. She's one of the more old school. I think a lot of romance readers now read like Victoria Dahl and Courtney Milan and Sarah McLean, who are all fantastic, although Courtney Milan tends to be really anachronistic. But I was introduced to Mary Jo Putney by one of my 80-year-old patrons, regulars. And she's done a lot of stuff that I really, really love. My favorite series of hers is probably The Lost Lords, but there's also recently she did like The Bargain, which was really good. So, and there's that whole series. So I put in I think this is true of everybody who's been writing for publishing for like 20 or 30 years. Don't read the ones published in the mid-90s because books published in the mid-90s, romance novels published in the mid-90s had a lot more like kidnapping and rape as a genre regular. But I think her recent stuff is really phenomenal. Let's see. Who else? I think I talked about a lot of the people that I really, really love. Sherry Thomas, my favorite of her books is The Delicious. Or just Delicious.
Delicious.
Favorite. Yeah, so I mentioned Penny Royal Green. But to go back to it, I think that it goes on for too long, and there are a couple of books towards the end that you could skip, but if you read the first few and then read the very last one, which is Lion and Olivia's book, it's one of the best romance novels I've written and read in quite a few years. There are a few other ones that I wanted to talk about that I can't remember the name of because I don't use my Goodreads account at all.
It's all right.
But yeah, those are some that I love.
I'm going to touch on some that we have not mentioned, and I'm going to try to be quick because I have a list of probably 100 that I consider absolute must reads.
I read some of the same books, so I suspect that some of mine I'll be like, yes!
Yeah. And so for, I have enjoyed Sophie Barnes, not to be confused with Sophie Jordan, who I also appreciate, and they are funny, explicit, published by Avon. In the contemporary period, they are historical romances, but they are post-mid-90s, per Corey's suggestion. I love Elizabeth Boyle. I like some of her early stuff better than I like some of her later stuff. She is also a friend, full disclosure. Grace Burroughs is a woman whose source books picked up, and she is a practicing family lawyer who I think she had 30 books under her bed, and so they published a whole bunch of hers in the last 10 years. And what I love most about them is that the men in them have feelings, and they are physically affectionate with each other, with their brothers and their comrades in arms. And it's not in a me screaming, just kiss already way. They are just, they're fully realized people instead of just alpha men. I really enjoyed Seducing Mr. Darcy by Gwen Creedy, Gwen with a Y. It is a super explicit time travel romance in which the heroine comes very close to ruining Pride and Prejudice. and it's done with great good humor. I am dying to read Eva Lee and Megan Frampton, who are relatively newish on the scene. Avon published people. You know, I can tell by the font chosen for the covers that I will probably like them. And oh my goodness, Anna Campbell. She's Australian, and she has written these standalones, one is called Seducing the Courtesan, maybe? Something like that. Anyway, there is a courtesan who is the heroine. Did I mention Elizabeth Hoyt?
Not yet.
She is awesome. And she has written a series of 6 or 7 books that we have here that I can't remember the name of the series.
The Raven Prince and the... Is it that series? Is that her? The Raven Prince and the...
Yes, she wrote those. And those are good because they have an overarching fairy tale. Yeah, I like those three princes. Those are really good.
Also good for fairy tales is Eloisa James has some really good fairy tale ones.
She does.
Are you going to do your Eloisa James spiel?
I was going to try to keep it positive.
Oh, okay.
If you have
James books, I have not liked particularly, but I did like the fairy tale ones.
I think it's very interesting that in her first series, which was Enchanting Pleasures and Potent Pleasures and Midnight Pleasures, she got, as a Shakespeare professor, she got some orders of precedence wrong. And that, like, made me hysterical. And then I found out just a couple of years ago, I was trying to get we would buy everything for the library, and she had made a specific request that one of her title's ebooks not be made available to libraries herself.
Boo.
And I was like, done. And I have just a couple more. If you haven't read Sally McKenzie, they're very slapstick. One is called Betting Lord Ned, and they are funny.
Betting, B-E-D-D?
Yes.
Okay.
And the Naked Mark, and then she did the Naked ones, which is like the Naked Marquis, the Naked Duke, the Naked Earl. And she had this trope at the beginning where the heroine would be thrust into the bedchamber of a naked nobleman at a house party and thus compromised. And in one of them, there is a hilarious cat who steals everyone's knickers and places them in the wrong places. And I think that I have saved the best for last when I tell you about Tessa Dare, who my absolute favorite is Any Duchess Will Do, in which the nobleman's mother has bundled him into a carriage when he is dreadfully hungover and has dragged him out to Spindle Cove. Spindle Cove is also known as Spinster Cove, and that's where the series is set. And all of these blue stockings are sent away to Spindle Cove to think about the wrongs they've done, and they are variously married off during the course of the series. But they stop for lunch in Spindle Cove, and the nobleman's mother drags him into the pub and where all of the ladies are lunching, because it's a spinster town, and so the ladies can be in the pub. And she's like, "You have to get married." And he's like, "Fine, I'll just pick someone." And she's like, "Fine, pick any of these." And she's like, waves her arm around the pub, and he's like, "I'll take her." And of course, it is the barmaid. And naturally, hilarity ensues.
I wanted to digress for a minute into, so like a cozy mystery, a historical romance will sometimes have a punny title.
Yes, we love the punny
such
titles.
Such as Forever Your Earl, or Dukes Prefer Blondes, and some of them are a stretch.
Yeah.
As any good pun will try to do, and some of them are quite good, and when I'm ordering these for the library, sometimes they result in earworms that last forever.
Jill Shalvis does that contemporarily on purpose. All of her books are titled with song titles.
I appreciate a good punny title, and I'm glad that romances do them as not as much as cozy mysteries, but in the same spirit. So, I don't have a lot to add.
We've listed everyone who's published a romance novel in the last 50
No, you
years.
Have not listed one of my favorites, which is Cecilia Grant.
Right.
She has 3 full-length and 1 novella out in her series about one family. And the first one is called A Lady Awakened, and I have reread it several times, which I don't do a lot of rereading, and listen to it on audio. It has some of the best descriptions of awkward sex that you'll find.
Now, if there's anything that's hot, it's awkward sex.
So I'll set it up. This can be my entry into the TBR challenge. If you haven't read it already,
I did follow this. Okay.
There's a woman who's got like a terrible husband, older husband who dies suddenly, and she is going to be like kicked out because she doesn't, you know, she doesn't keep control of the estate unless she gets pregnant, and so she somehow comes to the arrangement with this neighbor who's been sent to the country to like try to stop being a dissolute rake in the city by his father, that if she gets pregnant
quickly enough
she's somehow like suggested that she might be pregnant and then like buying her time before she gets kicked out, and so she's trying to get pregnant, but she doesn't actually like sex, and so every day he comes over and they try, and so it's like a gradual. At the beginning she's like, all right, lights off, close your eyes, do what you have to do. And he's like, can I, it's a little hard for me. I need some kind of mood setting. And so she's like, fine. This is like a gradual warming on her part and a gradual like awakening to responsibility and the fact that other people might have feelings and on his part. And then it gets really hot. So it's a very good book. I recommend it highly.
Okay, so there's a book that I loved recently, and it might have been a Mary Jo Putney. I thought it was a Mary Ballog. Someone maybe will remember, about a guy who is famous for his science writing, but actually it's his childhood female best friend who's doing all the science.
Nice.
She is widowed, and her dead husband, yeah, she must be widowed. Her dead husband was abusive and she miscarried a number of times and almost died. And so she is not at all excited about having sex because there's no good birth control in the time period.
Right.
And so they do a lot of figuring out how they can be intimate without necessarily putting her life in danger. And it talks a lot about how you can't be, I'm going to have to find the title of this book. I'll find it somewhere. How you can't be, oh, it might be a Courtney Milan, how you can't be, famous as a science writer or a scientist as a woman, and how you can't necessarily hold your spouse accountable for rape if you're a woman. Like, there's just a lot of that, and I really, really, really liked it. And now I'm trying to figure out, it is The Countess Conspiracy by Courtney Milan, and it's one of my favorite that I've read.
All right. Sounds good. Is that your entry into the TBR challenge?
Yeah, it's my TBR challenge. Read Courtney Milan. Especially if you are worried about romance novels not being feminist enough, because she, despite being somewhat anachronistic, does fall firmly on the feminism side.
Which is, I feel like if your anachronism is to make things more feminist, then I'd probably give you a pass.
Yeah.
So hold on. I want to also mention Ava Ibbotson, mm-hmm. Who, again, I have a tendency to like the Georgette Heyer, the Patricia Varian, there's a kiss. Sometimes there's, in Patricia Varian, there will be sex, but it'll be like one time and maybe you're already married. And so Ava Ibbotson falls in that category of like a gentle romance, but she has uniformly delightful characters. And so if you're picking up one, A Countess Below Stairs is good. A Company of Swans, if you are into ballet dancers.
And this is the same Ava Ibbotson of The Secret of Platform 13.
Yes.
That she has written 4 or 6 of those.
Awesome. She wrote the one about, romances. Abominable snowmen, yetis, that we read recently.
That's right.
And recommended on this. What is your entry into the TBR challenge, Eileen?
So my entry into the TBR challenge is not going to be very exciting, but because...
Is it going to be one that none of us have read?
No, I think it's going to be one that all of us have read.
so it'll be really easy. And it is Courtney Milan's Unclaimed, in which the hero is a virgin and the heroine is a courtesan. And it is part of a trilogy. A trilogy. Unveiled, Unclaimed, and Unraveled. And then there's the novella Unlocked. There's a theme in the titles, in case you didn't recognize that. But I loved Unclaimed because the hero is a moralist. He is a writer. He is famous throughout society for being the most virtuous man ever to have lived. And he goes off to the country and ends up meeting and becoming friends with a respectable lady, or so he thinks. And it's good and it's sexy and it's the kind of anachronistic that I like. And it turns, you know, he's a sir, but he's not a duke. And I just liked it a lot, and I recommended it to a lot of people for a long time.
You recommended it to me.
Did you read it?
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you.
So, case closed. Already done.
Have you read it, Corey?
I read there was something about it that I didn't like very much, and I didn't finish it, but I don't remember what it was.
And that is actually one of those really wonderful things that I always like to remember to tell people, that it is no skin off my nose if you don't like something that I suggest, and I would rather you read things that make you happy.
Well, the other thing that's true is that I may have been reading it during maternity leave when I was very, like, picky about what I was reading.
Nope, I'm not reading it. Because you only had so much brain power, and this was not worth it.
But I think that was the first Courtney Milan that I tried, and I was like, I like something about her, but I'm not sure I like this book. And then I read all of the other ones.
Uh-huh.
So, well, there we go.
So if you, as a listener, like historical romance and you want to recommend someone that we forgot on our list, maybe you know of a male historical romance author. Maybe you know of some traditional Regency Georgian romances that we somehow missed.
I didn't talk about reading the Marion Chesney books, are in the Patricia Varian line, where she did these little series of six.
AKA.
And one was A House for the Season, and one was The Six Sisters.
Yep.
And
yep.
Marion Chesney is also M.C. Beaton of mystery fame. And I read those. They were shelved in the teen section when I was a young person, and I devoured them.
I have an auxiliary recommendation. Because one of the tropes of all romance novels is alpha heroes, and one of the greatest beta heroes I have discovered in recent years is in Cotillion by Georgette Heyer, and his name is Freddie. And he is very much not an alpha guy, and that is the best thing about him. And
is
so
he like Freddie Einstred Hill?
I'm just going to read this, and it will Mr. Standen, who had turned to observe himself in the spotted mirror over the fireplace, discovered that his neckcloth needed an infinitesimal adjustment. Until this delicate operation had been performed, it was plainly useless to address questions to him. And that is how it goes.
I can't think if my neckcloth is
No, you can't. There's this passage I was looking through. There's this passage where, so he's become fake engaged to someone in order to further her ends, and he's trying to do the minimal that he can do just to help her out, but he ends up, like, advising her on fashion and getting her vouchers to Almax, and then refusing to let her waltz, and then... So, yeah, he's great. I like him a lot. Okay. So, we are at the part of our show where we talk about our obsessions, our musical obsessions. Start first. Corey, what have you got?
So I'm terrible about listening to music, partly because I live with my mom and my baby, so I have to listen to things that most of them like. But my baby is obsessed with Jay Berry, which you guys may not know about because you're not children's librarians, but Jay Berry is two Canadian children's librarians who have a YouTube channel where they sing every Storytime song ever made, and it's a phenomenal resource for Storytime librarians. And also, my eight-month-old is in love with Dana and Lindsay, and he gets really, really, really excited when he hears the music that starts up any of their videos and stops crying. So
hey, that's good.
That's awesome.
I know them on Twitter.
They're great. I just downloaded the new Selena Gomez album from Hoopla.
Perfect.
Love You Like a Love Song, and I was like, let's see what this is. And so it's, I don't think any of the songs have caught me as much as Love You Like a Love Song did, but the sober song I really like. And also it has made me like headcanon that she and Pink are singing to each other in their songs about being sober. Like Selena Gomez's song is about how like the person only loves them when they're not sober. And Pink's song is like, how do I do this sober?
Perfect. This is a good headcanon.
Bisexual headcanon.
I think that seems like it could be true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah.
How about you, Eileen? Me? I have had Genie in a Bottle in my head since yesterday, so that's what I'm going with. Oh, Christina. Xtina.
Xtina. my musical obsession has been wrestling with iTunes. And so it's hard for me to pick just a single song, as I have been trying to get the right music on my phone so that my car, which talks to my phone via Bluetooth, doesn't actually always play the same song every time. And so the song I will add to our Musical Obsessions playlist in honor of my struggle with iTunes is Angel Eyes by ABBA, because it plays everything it alphabetically.
Does. Look into your angel. Yeah. I didn't really know that song before
before my phone started talking to my car.
Your car started playing it every time you got in the car. Like, she doesn't even have to plug her phone in. She just had to have her phone in the car, and her car is like, well, you must want me to play the first song.
Okay. And it's really awesome if my phone is dead when I get in the car, and I plug the phone in, and then we're driving along having a conversation,
and then suddenly
Abba starts singing spontaneously.
It's like in How I Met Your Mother, where his car only played I Would Walk 500 Miles for, like, 10 years.
Which is, like, the best...
That's a good musical obsession.
The best
I'll
thing.
Have to remember that for next time.
Yeah, like, we'll definitely have Proclaimers on the musical obsession list in no time. What's your regular obsession, Corey?
So I have been obsessed for the last couple of seasons with MasterChef Australia, which I think that there's... Well, wait, I'm not actually sure there's a way to get that legally. Maybe don't put this on the podcast.
Shh, people can buy things on the internet.
Yes, they can.
Okay, so
if you can find it, how about that?
MasterChef Australia. It's exponentially better than regular or U.S. MasterChef. There are a lot of episodes, or like 8 episodes per season, or some ridiculousness. But they spend a lot more time focusing on the
cooking,
the food, on the cooking.
What?
And, and they spend a lot more time teaching the participants. And the participants start out with a much higher level of cooking knowledge. So you actually are seeing really interesting food. And the producers, for whatever reason, I've watched the first season and there's more of this, but I think it didn't go over well with the audience. So the producers really don't do any of that sort of producer baiting of like saying terrible things about your other contestants. There's none of that.
That's good. I hate that about reality shows.
Everybody's really, really focused on helping each other and being supportive and you know, they stand up on the mezzanine and tell people, hey, you left your crumbs in the oven and they're gonna burn or whatever. And
oh my god, that's so awesome.
Yeah, also there's no Gordon Ramsay, so there's none of that like posturing and throwing people's food in the trash and whatever. There's
it's the Joe guy that's the worst about that.
There's none of that. There's all of the like just people really trying to help other people be better cooks. When people do well, not even necessarily win, but just do well in the competition, they often end up with food careers, ongoing careers. It's actually really excellent, and I love it a lot.
Okay, that sounds good. My regular obsession is a podcast called Witch Please, which I think Two Bossy Dames probably tweeted about. I could be wrong, but I'm going to say it was Two Bossy Dames. So I am not a Harry Potter super fan. I have probably read each of the books one time. Maybe I read Goblet of Fire twice. But anyway, I'm not like a compulsive rereader of Harry Potter or anything. However, this podcast is an academic discussion of the Harry Potter books and movies by these two Canadian women who are academics. And it's just really interesting to dive into the Harry Potter texts and to think about things like fat shaming and Hermione is a white feminist, and labor politics, and diversity and sexuality. Like, is there birth control in the Harry Potter world? Who knows? And things like authorial intention. Their position is that basically there are no gay people in the Harry Potter world, and J.K. Rowling can go back and say, oh, Dumbledore was gay all along, but since she never wrote anything that indicated anything about that while she was writing, that doesn't matter. And so they do things that are like, they have different segments, and they discuss the books, and they discuss the movies, and the differences between them, and like the adaptations, and the choices of the actors that were done, you know, the process of adaptation itself. And it's just really interesting. It's like being in college again and doing deep reading of stuff, except it's Harry Potter. So I recommend that. It's also only like, you know, it's less than 25 episodes long, so it's not a huge commitment. It's still ongoing, but they don't have that much new material, obviously.
Right.
I assume they'll do something with the Cursed Child. Aline.
My current obsession, and it might have been an obsession in the past, but I am re-obsessed, so I'm going to mention it, is the Buy Nothing movement, which, if you don't know about it, and you are a user of Facebook, you should search Buy Nothing and the name of your town, or your area, if you live in an area, because it is a way, usually a closed group that is moderated by someone in the community, and you can post things that you need, or things that you want to give away, and people respond saying, I would like that box full of coat hangers that you don't have any use for. And you can drop it off at their house or have them pick it up off your porch. And it cuts out thrift stores. So if you think that thrift stores are an evil middleman, then this is a way to bypass that process. But it also gives you an opportunity to just give something away in your community to someone who actually wants or needs it instead of throwing it away. I've given away a lot of really random stuff this way, and sometimes I can't give something away. Like, we had a functional DVD player that nobody wanted, but we've given away a bed and like the aforementioned box of coat hangers and moving boxes. Like, I have all kinds of boxes that I can give away. It's a great outlet. It saves money and time, and it works if you are doing the Marie Kondo thing.
Yeah, for sure.
And you don't have to photograph as beautifully as you need to sell something on eBay.
You don't have to sell anything, and you don't have to go anywhere. Like, I feel like taking stuff to the thrift store involves a conscious effort to, like, gather things and put them in the car and then go by the thrift store and then drop them off when the thrift store is open, and then maybe they won't take whatever it is that you have or some of the things you have. And so this way, people are looking for the strangest things.
They really are. And people will take the strangest things that, like, they didn't take the VCR, but they took, I can't even remember what's a good example, but I do not take many things from it. But when, like, we decorated the house for Christmas and I was like, okay, I don't need all the rest of this Christmas stuff. And we gave a bunch of it away.
You were giving away, like, just binders the other day.
Oh yeah. Like, used 3-ring binders. Those went really fast. It was interesting.
So anyway, Buy Nothing.
Yeah.
It's a cool local thing. It's like a little free library for stuff.
Yep.
All right. We made it to the end of our show.
Corey, thank you so much for joining us. It was awesome to have you.
Yes. Will you tell people where to find you?
Yes. You can find me on Twitter at HelensTwin, HelensTwin, and on Tumblr at Clytemnestra Storytime, although I really only tumble about a webcomic called Oh My God, Check Please.
I've been reading that.
So if you are into Oh My God, Check Please, which you ought to be because it's amazing, then you might want to follow me on Tumblr. Otherwise, you probably don't want to. A website that is rarely updated these days called Storytime Underground, storytimeunderground.org. And I also help facilitate the Storytime Underground Facebook page, which has more than 6,000 youth services librarians talking about youth services librarianship.
Also some adult services librarians that joined to post pictures.
Yes.
Just saying, there might not be entirely youth services librarians in there. I'm Anna, and you can find me online at Helga Grace, HelgaGrace.
And I'm Allie, and you can find me on Twitter at Surly Spice, SurlySpice.
And our in and out music was provided by Julie Jurgens, who is adding a tiny letter to her podcast, The Spin Down. You can find her on Twitter at Hi Miss Julie, HimissJulie.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.